Henry Rang here with Dr. Roy Clauser again, and we're in this philosophy class, and we're going to ask ourselves, why is the structure of an argument even important? Why study logic? Why do philosophers care that there's clear, concise understandings to verifying or making even true statements themselves? So as we look at this, and you're going to go in depth with different forms of logic and structural arguments and so forth, so we're not going to maybe get into all the weeds here. I just want to ask you, why is logic and studying logic, whether it's inductive, deductive, whether it's, you know, and there are probably all kinds of different ways of logic and theories of logic, so maybe we'll talk about some of that too. But why is this that important?
It's very important. What happens in philosophy, as in the sciences, is that people offer theories to explain the data that they're looking at. And a theory is an educated guess. It fills an explanatory gap in our knowledge. Okay. Simple. Here's a super simple example. I have red paint. I have blue paint. I mix the paint, and the paint turns purple. What else is true that makes it turn purple? Why doesn't it turn brown or green or something else? I can't get the answer to that by sticking my head in the paint. It, no matter how closely I look, not going to work.
Okay.
So I make guesses, and guesses might go like this. Paint's made of tiny particles called molecules.
Okay.
Molecules stick together in certain formations. One formation reflects the red wavelengths of light. Another reflects blue. When you mix them together, they clump together in another formation that reflects purple.
Okay.
And that explains why the paint looks purple. Okay, those are guesses. And then we try to give arguments to show that the guesses are true. And other people give arguments to show that there are holes in our arguments.
Okay.
And an argument means giving reasons for a belief.
Okay.
The reasons are called premises, and the belief defendants called the conclusion.
Okay.
So logic is a way of testing those arguments. You learn a logical system. It allows you to take the reasons, the premises, put them into a logical code, a notation.
Okay.
Put the conclusion being defended into the same code. And you can then, with logical rules that are self-evident, construct a proof that the conclusion follows. That is, if the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true too.
Okay.
Or if that's not true, you can find that it's not a valid argument. These premises can be true, and the conclusion still be false.
Mm-hmm.
So you have yet to give me enough reasons to believe this conclusion. And that's the way people in the sciences and in philosophy go at each other. They test theories by arguing, seeing what can be argued against them. They sometimes test them empirically. That is, does something turn out the way the theory predicts? But it's all done against the background of the reasons for, the reasons against, and weighing evidence, and then coming to a conclusion about the theory.
So what's the benefit for someone studying ministry or enterprise or anything else? What's the benefit for learning how to think logically?
Okay, I can quote you what some people have said to me. I was on the train going into Rutgers University one day where I taught logic, and I bumped into a man I knew from years before, and he greeted me, and I said, "How are things going? What are you doing?" He's vice president of the Philadelphia National Bank. He said, "Where are you headed?" "I'm going to Rutgers. I have a logic class." That was the single most important, most practical and useful course I ever had as an undergraduate. He said, "When I go before the board of the bank, I test all my arguments. I check them out, make sure they're valid. Every conclusion I draw is really supported by the premise. I'm not going to go in there and have them catch me out in a bad argument and make a fool of myself." So that's one.
So one benefit is just that when you're a leader, you are expected to articulate and communicate knowledge, insights that matter,
sure.
And you want to make sure that what you're communicating makes sense.
Yes.
So one benefit is that you're a leader and you want to communicate that which makes sense.
Or even if you're not and you want to become one, you want to do work that's tight logically.
Right.
Not somebody notices that you committed a fallacy or that your conclusion doesn't follow from the reasons you gave for it.
Right.
You don't want that. That's true in business. It's true in the military. It's true. The other guy who told me he did that was a lawyer. He said, before I go to court, I sit down and I take all my arguments and make sure that they're logically valid. Nobody's going to catch me out in a fallacy. So
one benefit is, as a leader, a Christian leader, you want to test what you're saying. Sure. Now, again, a lot of this, after you get the hang of it, you intuitively feel when something's even a logical fallacy.
That's true. When you get a facility with the rules, you can hear people make mistakes when they speak. You can picture it. And, of course, this is true about sermons, too, right?
Right.
I mean, you don't want to get up and give a bunch of reasons, draw a conclusion that doesn't follow from them.
Right.
There may be somebody in the congregation who's going to notice it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if people don't have that training, if you leave it hanging like that, a lot of people will sense, anyway, that something is wrong. It didn't connect. And they'll be right. They won't be able to put their finger on it, but they'll be right.
So what you're saying is not only the second benefit is that even if someone didn't study logic, there is sort of a intuitive, does that make sense
yes.
that people have.
Yes.
So, you know, they will hear what you have to say.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, a lot of people think logic is hard to study. Some people think it's boring. Some people think that logic is only for the PhDs, the Dr. Clausers out there. Is it for new leaders that are like at Christian Leaders Institute? Why?
Yeah. Look, logic used to be the basis of education. If you go back hundreds of years, people started out learning grammar, rhetoric, and logic. That was called the trivium,
right.
The three basic things. And it was called, they were supposed to be the ABCs, without
right.
which you couldn't do anything else. So you learned grammar so you could write coherently, you learned rhetoric so you could speak coherently, and you learned logic so that the arguments that you gave for your conclusions really followed.
Okay.
And in recent times, in the U.S. and Britain and Canada, at least I can speak for them, logic was a required subject of everybody entering college. And unfortunately, a lot of the colleges have dropped that. It's not a requirement anymore. But it should be. In fact, in my humble opinion, logic should be taught in high school. High school students are already being exposed to theories about a whole lot of things.
Right.
You, if you're going for a college degree or you're going to take a number of courses, you're going to encounter course after course after course where you'll be exposed to different theories on the same subject.
Right.
The same things explained this way by this theory, this way by this theory, this way by this theory. How will you judge who's giving the better reasons?
Mm-hmm.
How will you test it? Are you just going to flip a coin? No, you check out whether the premises look true and whether they really entail the conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And if more than one does, then you start examining the premises in the same
right.
way. It gives you a way to check it out. And it applies not only to theories, philosophy and science, but obviously, as we're saying, it applies to business, it applies to law, it applies to sermons, it applies
ministry,
to everything.
I will tell you, over the years of ministry, pastoral care ministry, there were many times when my logic training helped me. And I'll give you an example. Okay, so I remember 10 years maybe into ministry. And everything sounded fine. And I noticed that one of the people that were counseling always did the ad hominem fallacy. Okay, so explain to everybody what the ad hominem is.
It means that instead of addressing the issue, you attack the person.
Right.
So right after the war, Second World War, Winston Churchill got in financial trouble with his own finances. He eventually straightened that out, but he was proposing a budget for Britain, and somebody said, "You're proposing a budget for Britain, and you can't straighten out your own household."
Right.
Well, that's irrelevant. His budget still might have been right.
Right.
And so that's attacking the person instead of dealing with the issue.
Right. Yeah. So what I noticed is that, you know, as first, like in the first maybe 15, 20 minutes, I kind of got, I was in a sense sucked into it. Oh, that person, oh, really? And then I would face it, you know, well, now, so really, your bitterness is taking the joy away from your life. Okay, so we'd have just a few moments to talk about that, about, you know, like the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, or forgive as our trespasses have been forgiven. Okay, so anyway, there's a point, and I know that this person's life was just defined by that bitterness. But in every time we got to that place, the issue was forgiveness, the ad hominem argument would kick in. So at first, I go, oh, you're right. Oh, how could you forgive that person? How could you forgive that person? But really the issue is their bitterness was bringing great unhappiness.
That's right.
Okay, and so all of a sudden it occurred to me, hey, this is ad hominem. So it was a counseling moment, and so it allowed me to sort of say, you know, in some ways, again, I didn't say you have a logical fallacy here, because in ministry you don't do that. You say, you know, no. In some ways, the issue is you're getting through that bitterness. That's why you're coming to see me, and your life is very bitter because of it.
Yes.
Okay, so we can keep talking about why you can have convinced yourself for that bitterness, or you can expose a lot. I even said expose actually a logical fallacy other than logic, and the person laughed. Ah, what do you mean? Well, it was called the ad hominem logical fallacy, where you keep attacking the person is taking you away from your own journey.
Yeah, even if the person is in the right and has the right to
to
feel resentful, they can be eaten alive by their resentment. They have to let go of it.
Right,
and of course that's what that. The Lord's Prayer is actually dangerous, right?
Yeah.
You ask God, forgive me my trespasses as I forgive others. And if you don't forgive others, what are you saying?
Right.
Don't forgive me.
Right.
That's...
Well, see, now that's like really clear logic there. Yeah. Okay, so when back to the structure of logic and the Christian faith, how does that connect? I mean, so who invented logic? In your mind?
Okay, well, I think that logic consists of rules and laws about whether one belief entails another.
Okay.
And that's part of the law order of the world.
Okay, so God invented
God
a logical reasonable.
That's right. God has built logical laws into the world and into human consciousness. In a way that people naturally try to isolate those laws and use them consciously rather than just unconsciously. In the same way, the world really has quantity. And though we invent numbers to represent it, the laws that hold between the numbers aren't just inventions. There are discoveries. And so are
so we don't invent mathematical and logical principles, that we discover them.
We discover
They're God's laws already.
Yes. And
because creation holds together.
That's right. And in the history of logic, the people who helped develop it, well, chief among whom is Aristotle, the ancient Greek philosopher who died in about 300 BC, but he made logical laws divine. They were parts of the divine being. The divine being is pure logic. These are the laws of it. And because he so overemphasized it and actually revered it, he investigated and found a number of the laws and worked out a logical system.
Okay.
And that's ironic that it takes a pagan deification of logic to discover a lot of its rules.
Like a little sidetrack here. Would you say that happens often, that we see something so amazing in God's creation that we ultimately deify it? I mean, is that a common human...
That's what we need to be on the guard against, yes.
Right. Like we discover logic, and the next thing you know, we want to somehow deify it. Or we discover numbers, and we want to sing songs to numbers.
That's right.
Did anybody ever sing songs to numbers?
No, but they prayed to them.
They pray to numbers?
Yeah, Pythagoras.
The Pythagoras theory, we study that in
Pythagorean theory. Pythagoras and his community practiced mathematics, but they did it because they regarded numbers as the divine realities out of which everything is built. So things aren't all made of atoms for him. They're made of numbers. And that's why when we do calculations correctly, it always reality always corresponds to it.
Mm-hmm.
So in my first book, I have a copy of the Pythagorean prayer to the number 10. They actually worship numbers. It begins, "Bless us, divine number, thou that generates gods and men. For number begins with the holy, the pure unity, until it comes to the plurality, that's the 10. And the 10 it calls the mother and key holder of all things." Number 10.
So when you really take weird. Christian philosophy after this class, you can take that class and you're going to talk about some of those dynamics of making an aspect of creation, the deifying.
That's right. Turning some part of creation, some particular aspect of it, into the self-existent reality that generates the rest. And that's called naturalism, as opposed to supernaturalism, which means, no, there's a transcendent God creator who creates all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't self-sufficient or self-existent.
Gotcha.
In part or whole.
Okay, so back to logic. What are the studies of logic that you have observed over the years? The types of logic that are out there right now. And again, we may not get into all of them in this class, or even at Christian Leaders Institute, because in a sense we're not offering you a logic bachelor degree in anything. It's philosophy. But what are, if you were to actually get into the study of logic, what are the different types of logic out there?
Well, I just finished a logic course, so I'll tell you what we did.
Okay.
And what I did.
And you can take that here at Christian Leaders when it's available.
Yeah. We started with Aristotle's logic because it shows you how it's possible to see that language also can be made to be precise, and there are rules that let you see what certain reasons entail.
So what type of logic is that called? What is that called?
It's the syllogism.
Syllogism logic of Aristotle.
Right, of Aristotle.
Okay.
He invented the syllogism. If you have two premises and a conclusion, and if the premises are only about classes of things, like all animals are dogs, all dogs are living things, all animals are living things, just two premises,
gotcha.
You get the conclusion. If they're about classes...
Gotcha.
But if you want to put in something about an individual, then it doesn't work. So if you put all humans are mortal, Socrates is a human, you can't even write that in his system.
Right.
Therefore, Socrates is mortal, you can't write that either.
Right.
Because Socrates, it's not all Socrates, it's not some Socrates.
Yeah.
Socrates is the class, it's an individual.
Right.
So you can't do that, you can't do relations and so on. But it introduces the idea of entailment.
Okay.
That if certain things are true, something else has to be.
Right.
I actually heard a Christian professor say to a group of people, a group of students, they asked him about somebody's argument and he disagreed with him. And he said this other thinker's premises were true and his logic was perfect, but his conclusion was false.
Hmm.
Which shows he didn't know anything whatever about logic.
Interesting.
If an argument is valid... If its premises are true, its conclusion has to be false. It has to be true. It can't be false. That's logically impossible. You have to contradict yourself to say it's
right,
false.
Right, right.
So he just showed he didn't know anything whatever he was talking about. I'm sorry.
So one type of logic is the Aristotelian type of logic. What are some other ones out there?
Then we go to what was developed in the early 20th century.
Okay, so hold it. The Aristotle type logic... held sway
from 300 BC to the early 1900s.
That's like almost 5,000 years.
Well,
300 BC.
Yeah.
Okay, 300 BC, so 2,400 years.
Yeah, it's a long time.
It's a long time. Okay, so I got my numbers right.
Yep.
Now, let's go to that. So now you go all the way forward to the 20th century.
In the 20th century... Alfred North Whitehead and Bertrand Russell collaborated on a book called Principia Mathematica.
Okay.
They were concerned by the fact that mathematics had way outstripped its logical basis. Logical basis is just a syllogism.
Right.
And you're getting non-Euclidean geometries,
and you're getting Boolean
algebra, and people are going crazy. It's got to be, there's got to be a logic that handles it. So they put together a logic that's called the calculus of sentences, sentential calculus. And in that, they're able to take compound statements, not just simple ones, not just two premises, but a number. So they can do conjunctions, disjunctions, implications, and so on. And it worked out beautifully. It was a great achievement. And within, 30 years, less than 30 years, people had added quantifiers to this.
Okay.
Made it a predicate calculus.
Okay.
And the man associated with that is... accomplishment is Gottlieb Frege, German, and he found a way to make distinguish subjects and predicates, and add relations and so on, and with the same rules of replacement and inference, you can construct proofs. So now that becomes the shorthand into which things in arguments stated in language are translated into this shorthand, then you can apply the rules to the shorthand. So it's called a predicate calculus. And we end with that. And I even end with certain propositions in relational logic.
So you're talking about when in the logic course that you are here at Christian Lear's Institute.
Yeah.
So you're going to get into some of that. One more thing, and then we're going to end this discussion, and that is this concept of taking like Greek as a language. Do things like that, because we offer Greek 1, 2, 3 here. We, you know, Greek with the Bible written, the New Testament was written out of Koine Greek. Is there something about taking Greek that just helps you think more logically? and why?
I think so.
Okay, why?
I think the two greatest aids to training your mind are the study of logic and Greek.
Greek. Now, I study Greek, so I will tell you all that, you know, I took philosophy and with logic and learned all the syllogisms and all of that. But when I took Greek, it seemed like things came together for me even better.
You too. That's the
same. You found that? Yeah. It's like I started realizing relationships and, you know.
Because it's such a nuanced language, because it reflects all kinds of shades of meaning and so on.
Yes.
It's complicated. There are over 20 forms of the word the, as you know.
Yeah.
But you can do things in Greek, you can make distinctions and so on, that are difficult to make in others. You can make them in the others, but it takes a lot of words to get to it. So, for example, when Christ hung on the cross, the last thing he said is, "It is finished." All right, in Greek, that's tetelestai. And what that one word means in Greek is a project begun in the past to continue to the present has now been completed and will have effects to the future.
Yes.
One word.
Right.
And that's why no translation really conveys all that it means.
Right.
Yeah. There are other places I think of. The opening of the book of Hebrews is one that annoys me, that people don't translate all the nuance that's there. And it says, God who in different times and different ways spoke to our ancestors by prophets has in these last days spoken through his Son, who is appointed heir of everything.
Right.
And but the Greek says, God who in many times and different ways began and continued to talk to our ancestors by prophets has in these last days finished speaking in his Son, whom he has appointed heir of everything.
Right.
So the two verbs, the verb is talk, not spoke. But it's imperfect in the first case, an action begun and continued.
Right.
In the second case, it's aorist, an action completed.
Right.
It's over.
Yeah.
That's why there's no more revelation from God. That's why there are no more books. The Bible.
The Bible. The Bible is what it is.
The canon's complete. The church has always said that. And that's the reason.
Right.
Calvin cites that.
Well, see, notice the logic. the imperfect tense, and in Greek you'll learn the aorist tense, the completed tense, yeah. which is extremely logical, and that English doesn't have that kind of a feature like Greek has.
That's right.
So we have to be more intentional at times. But when you take Greek, it starts helping you think that way because you go, ooh, that's the imperfect. That's the aorist. And again, we're going far afield. But what we're talking about is the benefits to studying logic,
yes.
the benefits of this study, of taking philosophy, the benefits of taking the logic class. One last thing, and we'll conclude this segment, and that is logic and arrogance. Now, one thing that I noticed in myself when I learned logic and I realized that, you start seeing the world of people speaking illogically where they're using fallacies one after the other, and then you realize in yourself that you're using fallacy, and then someone uses a logical fallacy to make their point, and truth happens anyway, and you were arguing logically, they were arguing which was illogically, but still the it didn't go your way, and you realize that the hand of God was even defined logic in that moment as ministry, and it's really unfortunate. And then what starts happening, the tempter comes into your mind, and you start like looking at the world critically, and you know, all of those things. So in a lot of ways, as great as logic is, sometimes logic may bring correctness, but it still doesn't bring truth. And sometimes, like the humility of realizing that you know, that God is at work, and or, you know, humility is a higher virtue than being the answer man, that one passage yeah. about knowledge puffs up, love builds up. I think it's good because you can get all this and you could get empowered to be a little monster.
Yes, okay, that's true. There are people that can use this to become a royal pain.
Right.
Of course, that's not advisable.
No, and that's not love.
No, that's right. But by being able to see what's wrong with another argument doesn't mean that you use that as a club to beat somebody over
right.
the head.
Right.
You take it apart, maybe in some gentle and kinder way, and try to find something that you agree with the other person.
Right.
And show them that maybe what they agree with you on rules this one out.
Right.
Or makes it unlikely or something. And there are kind ways to do it. It doesn't have to be brutal, and I'm a know-it-all, and I'm going to beat you up intellectually. That's no place for that. That's very unchristian.
Well, and again, in ministry training, we want to be diaconess, servants, but we also want to be wise. I mean, I always reflected on when Jesus once said to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. You know, his point being like, look, know your logic, yeah. know your mathematics,
sure.
know your ministry training. Understand that this is very important. On the other hand, love people. You know, if I can speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but I have not love, I'm an sounding gong. Or if I have the logic that can move science, but have not love, I am still nothing.
Yeah. You know, that this applies to something even if you're doing work with other philosophers and people mm-hmm. that are exposed to their logic
right.
know better than to give you an invalid argument.
Yes.
But the reason for being able to construct, put the argument into the logical shorthand and the conclusion, and suppose you can construct a proof, it's not a valid
yeah.
argument. The point of doing that isn't, ha-ha, you made a mistake, that's childish. The point of doing that is that when you do, mm-hmm. you can then see, very often, what other premises it would take to make the set of premises
yes.
entail the conclusion. And then you are uncovering the assumptions this other person has that may even be unconscious to that person.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're the unspoken assumptions that make the argument valid. And now you can evaluate those two along with the argument, the mm-hmm. premises that have been given. That opens up the whole discussion.
Right.
Gets at the hidden assumptions behind things, and so makes the whole exchange more profitable for both people.
So in that case, the logic is about love. And it's really about serving your neighbor and serving them in the way that brings out the best in them and yourself. So anyway, thanks, Doctor.
Good.
This was a great discussion about why we dive into understanding the structure of arguments and logic and all of those things. And as we develop this, you'll start seeing that the Lord will use good critical thinking to uncover his mysteries and his mercies. So, till next time.